Thank you, Asif, Nazila, Lamia, and Samina. We have a good 20 minutes for some dialogue, and let me just preface it by saying we would ask that your questions be concise or your comments be concise, and I'll ask our panelists as well to keep your answers concise so that we can get into, because you've raised a number of, not just a number of interesting issues, a variety of very interesting issues to engage here. So, and please come to the microphone with your questions so that we can... Yeah, if you have a question, come to the front and we'll
see you. Hello, ma'am. This is Meenakshi from India. My question is, what are the steps taken by the states to resolve the violence against women in Middle East countries?
Who wants to start? You to start.
No, I
didn't
hear the question. Should I repeat?
You go first, let me think. Okay, looks like everybody is saying who's going to first, and you, me, let me start. I think I'll focus again on Pakistan, and I hope by then you can come in and ask if please come in. I think the states, and again in case of Pakistan, the state had introduced the idea of violence against women through introduction of the Hudood Ordinance, which... again, we're not really only targeted against women of lower backgrounds, economic backgrounds. Even people from women of upper economic classes got impacted upon by that. But what we do see is that in the new millennium, at least, there has been a move on the part of the state to try and deal with those issues. So questions like sexual harassment at workplace is something that you would never hear about in Pakistan, say, in the 1990s, but it's an issue that's becoming significant. The rights of women and also the questioning of the Hudood Ordinance. So the Women Protection Bill, which was passed during Musharraf's time, was a way of saying that the state has a role to play. But we need to be very careful. The state has only a limited role to play because state is an inanimate object. State consists of people who have ideas, who have got values. And if those ideas and values are corrupted in some way, we cannot expect the state to have clear delivery of rights or enunciation of values on part of the state that really treat women equally. So you have people who believe in honor killings, and they get elected to the parliament. So when you talk about honor killing in Pakistan, they think it's okay. Now, in that sense, the state is issuing certain legislations, but the reality of the ideas is very different. So if you translate that into implementation or even of policies or creating of ideas at the grassroots level, you can easily come to the conclusion that the ability of state legislatures to be the models of changing becomes very limited. It also feeds into then how the police and other law enforcement agencies come in. So, yes, there's a shift, but... it isn't really complete.
I would argue to the contrary. The state has an unlimited role in against violence against women. Of course, through legislation, state can enact laws against violence against women, but at the same time, it is the practice and the applicability of these laws. And there is, in Egypt, there is a wide gap between reality and law in this regard, as in many other rights as well. Violence against women in Egypt has been now on the crescendo side, unfortunately, and it has been used as a weapon in order to shut their voices, to shut their voices, the voices of women during the revolution and until maybe this moment. Sexual harassment and literally violence and against women in the squares when they go in demonstrations. Security forces send their agents in order to use violence against women, in order to strip their clothes and leave them naked in the street. I mean, this is really, in our culture, it's unthinkable. But this is to say that it is the role of the state to uphold rights, the role of the state to promote these rights and to make people respect them. And this is, and not to be used against, I mean, as a weapon against vulnerable groups. This is really my point, and I'll stop at that.
I just think probably we're both on the same side. I don't know if there was a space for disagreement, because what I'm really saying is state has a right and a responsibility, but we also need to accept that state has limits because of what constitutes the state. And so having legislated it, there's no guarantee that it will be implemented on ground level because of the thinking that is prevalent in the society. So the thinking has to change before the real legislation gets implemented.
One small word. Yes, the state is composed of persons, but the state is also composed of people who want to stay in power. And this is the problem.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Further comment? Can I see that?
Okay. I in a way agree with both, and I dare not agree with either, in fact, in the interest of women's rights, I guess. I would like to sort of expound a little bit more on what Samina has referred to. In Pakistan, I'm so happy she talked about political economy. Social aspects, which is so much more important. A lot of changes at the legal level have taken place, and they've not taken place just recently. Long time back when Dr. Fazlur Rahman went back from McGill and suggested changes in Muslim personal laws, a lot of steps were taken which sort of gave women a great deal of rights in personal law that were hitherto unknown of. And since then, there have been further, developments like the Hudud laws, Samina referred to, there have been discussions and changes in laws of evidence, laws pertaining to how rape victims could sort of file their cases and so on and so forth. There's an immense change, particularly in personal laws. But the real issue is the society itself, and on the other side, it's not just the legislation, it's also the procedure and the implementation which is a big problem. For instance, and then of course, in terms of implementation, the whole class division becomes a very, very important aspect that needs to be considered. The same laws will perhaps not even be invoked or accessible to a woman in the lower classes. The dynamics of upper classes is entirely different. In the middle classes, I dare say sometimes, the laws can even be discriminatory towards men. There's a voice coming up for a kind of masculinism as well. So it really depends on the power dynamics. And that is an aspect which is sort of the antidote to that. I'm not saying should not involve state involvement, but has to sort of involve the state at not just the legal level, but in terms of state's encouragement of education, awareness through media, and the social responsibility. That too is now an emerging voice, especially through the role of the civil society.
Thanks. Actually, that last comment picked up on the question I wanted to ask, which is, a number of you mentioned the role that religious leaders or religious social forces have played in transforming some of the states in the Middle East in terms of their attitude towards religious minorities. So my question is, what role or responsibility do states have vis-a-vis engaging religious leaders? And in what ways ought they engage religious leaders who are propagating various forms of extremism or prejudice?
Back
Since you're the only one.
So it's
you're the only man, so we've been kind to you.
Masculinism.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the most important aspects that is not really given a lot of emphasis as yet. The engagement with the scholars is there, but there are a lot of misgivings on both sides. First of all, again, it's a problem of superficiality. The second issue is of the exigency of the whole thing. Like, I mean, what is expedient is considered to be the best solution rather than a thorough academic probe into what really the problem is. I'll give you two examples. One is the example of the Red Mosque debacle, which a lot of people might know about. In case you don't, you know, there was during the times of Musharraf, some religious women took control of certain public space, and they tried to implement the Sharia ad baculum through the stick, you know, there was a military action as well. And it was resolved in a way through the state force, which obviously it had to need at some point, but without the involvement of the mainstream ulama, and very few people really understood the important role that the ulama could have played, because whatever these women were doing was against the mainstream religious ideas of the scholars. And I myself had a debate with the wife of one of the clerics involved. Her name is Umm Hassan, 1 year after the whole event. And I think that was probably the first time any person on the television media started talking in terms of the Quran and Hadith that she would need for a meaningful engagement. And within 10-15 minutes, I still remember, she said, "Brother, I was never told these things. This is a fully qualified madrasa graduate. And I would like to think about these things." This is one year down the road. So there's a really serious lack of understanding. Similarly, when you talk about madrasas, this is the second example. The mainstream understanding in the Western discourses, especially through the media, like the superficiality of the media itself is a problem. Most of the mainstream madrasas were opposed to Talibanization, to their modus operandi. How many people, for instance, know that Mullah Umar was heavily criticized by his own teacher in Deoband, in Akora Khatak, who wrote him letters which have been published, chastising him for adopting a discourse which was totally against. But these things have not been properly utilized, mostly because of political reasons, but also because of reasons of superficiality, you understand?
I'm not sure whether you mean the states where the clerics themselves are living or other states. So I, for one, I'm not a Muslim, but I, for one, when the Sheikh Al-Azhar and the foreign minister of France went on TV and said face coverings are not Islamic, I wasn't really, I didn't really think how will that be persuasive to a person who is following their religion or has an interpretation or understanding that they cover their face. Why would having your Sheikh and the foreign minister of France be at all persuasive for you? It seemed rather bizarre. So definitely, I think there's big question marks about other states coming in and handpicking their clerics from the geographic context they're interested in. And, too many dangers and issues could arise there. In terms of the state itself, certainly it has a due diligence duty. So, whether a violation is from non-state actors or the state itself, the state has the duty to try and prevent and to protect at all times, including violence against women and including violence against minorities or any acts of discrimination. And part of that due diligence may be to engage with whoever the voice of discrimination is, which may, unfortunately, sometimes also be religious leaders. I'm more comfortable with civil society itself and individuals being in touch with the religious leaders. So, I gave the example of the fatwa of Ayatollah Montazeri, and when I was in Qatar recently, I heard that some professional women from a particular ministry had been in, they wanted to challenge the question of why they can't pass on nationality to their children if they're married to foreign men. They brought a group of Islamic scholars together. They said, "Is there anything Islamic about not women not passing their nationality?" The scholars said, "Absolutely not." So they're challenging the seat or reservation by their state. I find that just a much healthier interaction and less subject to being instrumentalized and politicized.
I think we better move to the next question just for the sake of time. Just.
Hello, I'm Jyotsna from India. I'm having a question, particularly reference to Pakistan. Specific beliefs and practices are contrasted negatively with Islam in textbook of primary and secondary school of Pakistan. Isn't government somewhere itself nurturing fundamentalism and cultural violence? And on the other hand, it's founding minority institutions, favoring them.
So what I'm going to suggest here, since we have three questions left, maybe if someone wants to take that question, then we'll maybe have one response to each.
Well, if I can just quickly say, one, the textbooks are being changed a little bit. So the state had introduced ideas that are now being shifted. But I think that question assumes that most of the Pakistani kids go to the state schools. The reality is there are different school systems. Upper class have got schools that you can't even imagine for poor people. Then you've got government schools, and then you've got schools that are madrasas. And even privatized schools, you've got schools for upper class and school for the middle and the lower classes. And they've got different curricula. So to assume that it's that information that's creating violence, I think the answers, they're partly to be used as an answer, but really the explanation is a lot more varied, picking up all the other factors that I talked that really contribute to a sense of violence. Does that?
Yes.
I can go on, but I'm just worried that we're running out of time.
Yes, you can go on.
Maybe we can talk about it more later on. Is that okay?
Yes, it's a good game.
Maybe we'll just limit to the one point. Is there a conflicting response very quickly that we should
yes.
add in, or
yes.
just to stir the pot?
Okay.
Okay. We'll go to Dorothea then. You have a question as well. Thank you, Jester.
I'm Dorothea from Kosovo. I come from a country which is 90% Muslim, 6% of Christian community, and Orthodox, and 1% of other. After the war with Serbia, we still don't have the common ground with them. And in a way or another, we are still in conflict. And what I really don't understand is why my country isn't using religion to soften this hatred we have for each other. So I just thought asking you, how can religious leaders have influence in the political context and post-war countries, especially without the state interfering? Thank you.
Someone else has to take it.
That's exactly the point that I was trying to make, and just like to respond to what my panel member has just said. You know, like, I mean, states, I mean, we don't live in a utopia. We live in the real world. States do intervene. They do make laws. They do, you know, like, do things which affect everybody. And that's why just as other members of society, civil society, individuals, need to interact with each other, state also needs to be a more responsible and a more aware actor in things to make things meaningful. But at the level of individuals, certainly, you know, like, I mean, the ulama, I think, or the scholars, this ulama, they're called ulama in the Muslim world, you know, like properly certified scholars. They're not the only scholars, you know, they're other independent thinkers as well. But the traditional ulama have a lot of authority in terms of dealing with the more traditionalist people, the people with a more confined outlook. And quite often, I have seen that the ulama do not even bring out their own discourse fully. Like in the case of Talibanization in Pakistan, for instance, it was through much pressure that the ulama gave a combined fatwa explaining that their mainstream discourse did not accept suicide bombing, that it did not accept this kind of violence, that there was no room for any kind of jihad without the authority of the collectivity. But why weren't they sort of presenting and explaining these ideas earlier? Their combined fatwa or their combined communique gave an explanation for that as well. It's because, well, these are our brothers, and they are, after all, fighting against the U.S., so they were kind of stifling their own voice for political reasons. And I don't think they have, number one, played their role in terms of even bringing out what they themselves believe in. And the state also has sort of, for its own political reasons, not really interpolated that voice as it should have.
Okay. We'll take one last question.
Hello. Well, first of all, I want to thank you, the panelists, for the valuable contributions. Well, my name is Sergio. I come from the University of Ulster. I'm an economist, but I'm originally from Peru in South America. It seems that in the case of Pakistan, there is a positive correlation between violence with the levels of increase in poverty, inequality, you know, what I heard. In the case in Peru, for example, 20, 15 years ago, we have the same levels of inequality, poverty, especially in the Andes area. And that caused the levels of violence expressed in the case of terrorism in that case. These groups, they couldn't use religion as an excuse to for these levels of violence because in Peru, 99% of the population is Catholic. But what they used was another type of excuses like ethnicity, colonialism, and with those issues, well, they impose the violence. I'm wondering if in the case of Pakistan, maybe this religion between Sunnis and Shias is just an excuse to express that oppression of levels of inequality and poverty. So that might be the case? Thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you said that. At least that's the way I look at it, is that if you've got loss of hope and if you've got poverty or inability to really live it at a standard that you think is comfortable, then you start listening to narratives that justify what you think can be done. And if one of the narratives is one that says that you need to, the source of your problem is not just you or the system, but particular people, then I think if you get taken in by that narrative, then it's quite easy for people to turn their attention. And then we also must not underplay the role of mob violence. I mean, I've seen situations in Pakistan where some young men accused of having a girlfriend of someone or teasing someone, suddenly lynched mob by everyone. And it's nothing to do with religion, but suddenly somebody says, he has done something un-Islamic, and off everybody goes there. So I think there is definitely, I mean, I'm not saying that religion doesn't have a role to play. I think religious narratives and the way people pick it up have got a very important role. But at the same time, there are other explanations as well that also come into it. So when we're dealing with religious inequality or violence against communities, just talking at the religious plane doesn't solve the problem. Talking at the religious plane, but also dealing with other issues, does settle the issue.
Yeah, I just wanted to recall that there's a sociologist at MIT, I think, Professor Fisher, and he talks about this. He looks at Iran and he looks at sort of episodes of violence, especially mob violence and lynching and everything against religious minorities during different periods of Iranian history. But I think he makes a wider point. He refers to this as religiously phrased protest. And he says, in suffocating political environments where there is no tolerance for any kind of protest, this becomes like the safety valve for the population, that wherever there are tensions in society, the only way it can be expressed is by killing a few religious minorities or protesting against minorities. It could be that some of the blasphemy protests are also, it has its own logic as well, but it's also the only acceptable protest that is tolerated in that society. So we need to be aware of that. I agree with you absolutely, but that doesn't mean we compromise that there should be freedom of religion or people or full equality or human rights. And so those international objections or bilateral or multilaterals need to continue and pinpoint all the human rights violations that are occurring. But we need to be vigilant that this is the protest, this is the language, these are the victims, but there might be a wider story, unfortunately, there as well.
Yeah, just like to add one dimension, which is something that my interaction with many of these people sort of brought out to me in full focus, which was the intervention of the government intervention and the intervention of international forces in terms of interpolating religion for political purposes, for international gains. You know, I mean, that happened in the past. I've often said that the Frankensteins of day of today have quite often been the heroes of our past. You know, like in those days, and this is what I mean, my debate with Umme Hassan, she said, okay, so if what we are doing wrong is wrong today, why was it right earlier? You know, by earlier she was obviously referring to the time when even John Rambo went and fought with the Afghan Mujahideens. You know, like, I mean, religion was used against the mainstream religion, religious discourse. And this identity of the freedom fighter in the name of religion, allowing that person or those people to take the law into their own hands for the sake of some religious, you know, like objectives. It was done earlier. So when those people, you know, once the genie is out of the bottle, it will not just stay in Afghanistan. It will move into India. It will move into U.S. It will move into other parts, wherever, you know, like, and why would that be wrong from their perspective? So, I mean, there have been a lot of mistakes which have been made, and those mistakes have to be acknowledged at the state level. I mean, I would like the Pakistani government at some point to acknowledge that it made mistakes. I'd like the U.S. to acknowledge that it made some mistakes. And then maybe we can move ahead.
All right, we better bring our time to a conclusion here. Thank you very much for taking part in this session, and a special thank you to our panelists for a really engaging dialogue. Please join me to thank them. So, we thank you for joining the forum this weekend. I want to say to the RELG 550 students in this room, you need to get your lunch and go to the senior common room for a group lunch. So for those students, especially when you get your lunch, please move to the senior common room downstairs. So thank you all.